Welcome to Disruptive Successor, a show for next generation leaders in family businesses and entrepreneurs who want to disrupt the status quo and take their existing business to a whole new level. We all know that what got us here isn't going to get us there. This show will provide inspiration, advice, and resources to help you create massive impact.
This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Hi, it's Jonathan Goldhill, and welcome back to another episode of the Disruptive Successor Show. Today, I got to sit down with Scott Snyder, who is the president of the Exit Planning Institute. EPI, Exit Planning Institute, is a professional educational organization that certifies advisors like myself in exit planning, and they teach their value acceleration methodology. Scott is also the operating partner of Snyder Premier Growth, a small investment company controlled by he and his dad. The Exit Planning Institute is basically a business that's run by he and his dad, along with 20 other employees. You'll get to listen to his story. And the interesting thing is that it starts out with Scott telling me about how he started a landscape company at 15 and sold it at 24. So he is the consummate entrepreneur and a disruptive successor. So let's welcome Scott to the show. Thanks.
How are you?
Morning.
Real good. Morning.
Good afternoon, actually, right?
Yeah, afternoon, morning, whatever it is, yeah.
Yeah. What's the landscaping poster written back there?
Oh, yeah, these are all my other projects. That was the first company that I ever started, the one
ground,
that I sold in 2000.
Maintenance.
Yeah, it was a traditional. I went to school at Ohio State for horticulture. So I started my first company at age 15 and then sold it when I was 24.
Good for you.
And then partnered with my dad, you know, there basically took a year off kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. And then partnered up with my dad and his business partner at the time, Andy, to go out and start his consulting practice. So, but yeah, that's it's literally like an old yard sign from a yard.
That's pretty funny. So I've spent the last maybe 15 years focused on the landscape industry.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I've been active in the California Landscape Contractors Association, some of the other state associations, many of the local chapters, and participate a little bit at the national level, having my articles in national landscape magazines, having my clients, client on the cover of Landscape Management Magazine, my client who in my book, which is called Disruptive Successor, I nominated him with Family Business Magazine as a next gen leader, and he's going to be getting the award for the next gen leader. So yeah, I've been focused on the landscape industry. I just got off a client call with a landscape company. So it's a niche that I know.
How did you get into that?
So interestingly, as a business coach, I was kind of looking for a niche, and it was right around 2004. When I became a business coach, I was looking for a niche, and I noticed that there were people like Dan Sullivan with Strategic Coach who were into what I call FIRE, finance, insurance, and real estate guys, and doing some entrepreneurs. But, and then I started looking at other coaches, and I started like, well, there's real estate coaches. There's like, I got to find a niche. And I suddenly moved into a house that had two awards for residential install and residential maintenance, but from the Landscape Association. And I just thought, wow, this is what I love about this house. I love the landscaping. And I started to see landscape trucks and contractors everywhere. And I started thinking, there's a lot of landscapers out there. You know, unlike the other trades, roofers, plumbers, you know, HVAC. I mean, how often do you change your air conditioning, or how often do you change your roof? But how often do you have your lawn and your, you know, your garden tended to, right? It's like going to a hairstylist
every week, right?
You know? And I didn't want to focus on hairstylists because that just
that's just not your thing.
No. And so there's tens of thousands of landscape companies that were in my market. They were $500,000 to $5 million a year in revenue, and they needed a lot of help. So that's how I focused on them.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, no, we, I mean, here in Ohio, right, we're full season. So we were doing the snow and ice management stuff.
Yeah.
We did mostly commercial stuff for what we would consider high image oriented properties. So properties that use their image to sell their product.
Mm-hmm.
So what we found is obviously that they were paying a little bit more and cared a little bit more. So we weren't like mowing shopping centers or factories or anything like that. We were doing like higher end stuff where we could really almost becomes like come like truly kind of like their groundskeeper.
Yeah.
You know, some of the properties we would actually have a guy there every day doing some stuff.
Yeah.
But no, it was fun. And one day I just got like the typical thing that we always hear about, an unsolicited offer. And the guy was September of 2009. And we actually used him for some like tree care stuff. So we didn't do any like big bucket truck tree care stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So he had like what I would consider kind of like an odd problem. He did a ton of snow and ice management. So he had the trucks and the equipment for snow and ice, but he was like, I guess for lack of better words, kind of crappy at selling actual landscape work. Maybe because his equipment didn't match what he needed there. I don't really know, but he had like was super underutilized in the main season. And he really liked our clients, our process, our employees, our equipment. And, literally he just, we're like on site one day.
There you go.
He was just like, Scott, have you ever like, we're like literally looking at a project, and he was like, you know, have you ever thought about selling your company? And I was like, I mean, it's what my dad does that kind of work, right? My dad does like M&A work and does like business consulting. So like, I know about it, but like, not really, you know, I'm just getting started, you know, but no doubt. Like, I think, you know, during the, you know, Great Recession, we certainly took a hit, you know, those high image oriented properties really started to pinch their budget down a little bit.
Yeah.
And you know, some of the big, more national companies that could do volume could really come in or do multiple. So you'd have like a Brickman, a True Green, Kemlon, a Valley Crest would come in and you know, be able to service the whole state of Ohio. So these large management companies that own like luxury apartments in Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati, one company would bulk all three cities together and do one price.
Yeah.
For the whole thing. And I couldn't compete. I really couldn't compete. So no doubt we certainly took a hit. And yeah, I don't know. I just decided to take the offer with my dad's advice, obviously, but like,
So what little
did I know that, like, you know, truly, certainly as a very young man, you know, your identity almost immediately got stripped away because I've done that. That was the only job I ever had.
Well, so Scott, how old are you now?
I'm 35 now.
And how old were you when you exited the business? 24?
24.
And so 11 years ago was 2010, right? Yep. At the start of the recession. So interesting story. Tell us what kind of can you tell me what kind of a multiple you got on the business now that you obviously must have looked back at that?
God.
Must have been.
I would have to think back. Honestly, I mean, it wasn't much. It's probably a pretty big multiple of earnings. Yeah,
it's
probably
a
pretty big multiple. I mean, you're not making like a shit ton of money in the landscape world. We had a lot of debt, though. You know, if I had you're 24, so think about, I don't know what you were doing at 24, but I even look back like the last 11 years of my career and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You know what I'm saying? Like the stuff I know now by surrounding myself with guys like you, I'm like, I must have looked like an idiot back then, you know, like, and you just didn't know. And my dad, you know, my dad has always been obviously a raving fan and one of my closest advisors, but like even back then, like my dad, I don't think even took me all that serious, right? Because mm-hmm. he's like, it wasn't really until I had two problems. One, obviously, I had the traditional problem of we grew way too fast. So, you know, I started the business founders when in high school with my buddy Mike, and you know, we were cutting lawns like on the weekend, right? Making some change for pockets. Then when we went to go to college, my buddy Mike went away to go to nursing school. And I stuck around because I primarily wanted to run my landscaping company, but my dad wouldn't let me go to horticulture school. He's like, you got to go to business school. So I went to business school and I hated it. I always hated school. So I hated it. And I did really good. I wasn't like a bad student or anything. I did good the first semester. But as the business started to take off and I started to hire some people, like the second semester of my first year of college, we really started to take off. And I was spending very little time actually on schoolwork. So I went from like a 3.4 GPA to a 1.75.
Oh boy.
It was really just because I wasn't doing anything. So right. I lost all of my academic scholarships my first year going into my second year. And I was driving with my dad and I kind of just blurted it out. And obviously you can imagine that my dad probably wasn't too happy. One, because I wasn't straight up and honest with him. And two, because I blew my scholarships. But I said, Dad, really like very serious conversation. Like, I don't want to do this. I want to go to horticulture school. And primarily is that one of the things, at least here in Ohio, is that there's not a lot of barriers to entry, right? Like we threw a push mower in the back of a sedan and called ourselves landscapers, right?
Right, right.
And so, you know, so once I did that, I went down to Ohio State's Agricultural Technical Institute, which is in Worcester. So it was only about an hour and 10 minute drive from my house. So I would classes like 2 days a week and I'd go down there all day and then I'd go home and work the rest of the week and then do it all over. And once I did that, we really started to go. Then I lasted there for only about a year and a half before I was like, Dad, I dropped out of college. And he's like, what? And I was like, Dad, I can't run my business and go to college. So once I left the traditional 4-year college, Dad said, I'm not paying for anything anymore. So if you want to go to horticulture school, you go and you pay for it. So it was my money anyway. So I said, Dad, I dropped out. And, you know, primarily, you know, there's a couple of reasons, but primarily is I really just wanted to run my business. And once we did that and Dad kind of got into it with me a little bit and really became like a real good like advisor to me, mm-hmm. we literally J-curved to the point where I can remember sitting there in my dad's kitchen saying like, dude, what are you doing? And I'm like, you're not excited. I just sold a $68,000 landscape contract. And they're like, you have absolutely no people or equipment to service that. So then, right. And then you have really in Ohio, you have really wet springs and really wet and cold falls. So it's like we had so much work jammed into a day that if we got a rain delay or a rain day, we would have to be missing whole weeks. And at these high image oriented properties, like they would get pretty pissed. And so I went like 1 year where I literally probably tripled the revenue of my company, but I was at like 21 or 22 years old. I literally had no idea what I was doing. And so I lost almost all of it the next year. And then was able to build it back the next year. And then, so that would have been like 2008, I guess. And then in 2009, we were a little bit smaller than we were 3 years prior, but we were at a pretty good position. But I had taken on a lot of debt. So most of that purchase price went to pay off debt. So I didn't really come out with like a lot of extra cash. Well, I certainly had more cash than the next 24-year-old.
What a good learning lesson and what a good...
I did so much stupid shit too. Like I bought like... I had so much cash as like a 22-year-old kid that I bought myself a brand new Infiniti MX-35 or something like that. It cost like 40 grand. And I walked in like I thought I was some badass. And I walked in with cash to the dealership. These guys thought I was probably like a drug dealer or something, right?
Right.
Like, what kid has that much cash?
Right.
And I just honestly, it was like my first lesson in like being humble and not letting like money get to you too. Like I wasn't like, you know, cocky or arrogant. I just didn't know any better, you know? So it's like, but yeah, I mean, it was just, so you're, and can you imagine, right? When you were 21, 22, 23 and navigating the the things that you have to navigate when you're a young man like that, whether it's, you know, my up buddies were all graduating college and getting into life. They want to play like sports, like, you know, co-ed sports. They want to go to the bar. They want to work out. And I was doing all that, but I had the most money, right? So I'm taking all the guys out all the time. And, you know, I'd show up to work the next day hungover as hell. And that my company would be looking at me in our like morning meetings. Like, is this like, who is this dude? Like, he used to be like a really inspirational guy. And now he's like kind of hungover every day.
Right.
So there was like, so in like a 2 or 3 year span, there's so many cool, like looking at it now, so many cool lessons I learned being a very young entrepreneur. But so, yeah, no, it was actually the coolest thing. So when we exited, I partnered up with Dad and we did Aspire Management for 2 years and then bought EPI. And then we did 2 years of that. And then I said, Dad, I want to go in and run this thing. At the time, I was a little, I was a little skeptical because obviously I'm not a big college guy, right?
Right.
I dropped out of college and now we own a professional education company.
Right.
But yeah, so long story, long answer, but I just a reflective moment where you're like literally across over here in my office, like on that, I don't know if you can see that table right there.
Yes.
There's a picture of me and Mikey and who was my buddy that started in 2000 and I don't know what that, I can't read that date, but there's like, it's like, we're just too young. We had like t-shirts that we got from Walmart and you could like iron on a logo.
Yeah.
You know, so we like just, we didn't know, cause we didn't know that embroidery even existed.
Yeah.
And we didn't have enough money to even go do it. So we just like printed something off on the computer and put the paper on here and one of those like iron on logos on our t-shirts. But I keep that picture away across from me all, you know, today to just keep me tied to the come from.
Well, this is a great story. And with so many of my clients having been in landscape industry, I suspect that we'll have landscape listeners. And
cool.
I think this is such a good take that we should just make this a live recording and have this
okay.
podcast.
Yeah, we can talk about this. Sure. Yeah.
So assuming that this is the podcast and we're going forward now. So then you get into your dad's business. And your dad is now, so Aspire Management, what was that exactly? It was,
my dad was a certified exit planning or is a certified exit planning advisor. So he had become a SEPA in 2008. And so when I came around in 2011, basically, because I took this random year off, right? So I sold the company in April of 2010 and then kind of did what most owners do, right? When you don't have a good personal plan, you kind of wander around. So now I'm a 24-year-old kid with some change in my pocket, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. So yeah, in 2012, Dad said, well, really 2011, Dad said, hey, come join my consulting firm. Mm-hmm. So he was doing probably what you're doing. He was coaching and consulting and helping business owners grow value in their companies and position for exit.
Yeah. And as I read, Chris's book, Chris is your dad. I read Chris's book, which is called Walking to Destiny, I kept thinking like, this is just like Rockefeller Habits, like scaling up gazelles, which is what I was certified in at the time. And I thought, I'm sure he knows Vern Harnish and has been networking with EO or whatever the groups are. And so, his book was the beginning, I guess, or the defining of the value acceleration methodology and the process that an owner needs to go through to walk towards greater freedom and fulfillment. And so, so it's great. And then fast forward then a couple of years, you guys buy the Exit Planning Institute and think that you'll take this over and basically scale this business up. And so what is the Exit Planning Institute? I know because I've been to many meetings, but for our listeners,
the Exit Planning Institute is a professional education company. So we support professional advisors really of all kinds. So business consultants, financial advisors, and CPAs, amongst all the others, really any advisor that's trying to help an owner grow value in their business and position them for a potential exit, whether they're, you know, a year away from exit or 20 years away from exit, it doesn't.
Right.
Matter. We teach that exit planning as business strategy is that there's really nothing different, right? The same things that you would be doing in your business right now are the same things that you should be doing in your business to exit. So why not focus on the right now and drive value? So we do that through the value acceleration methodology and we teach that process to professional advisors. with the intent to say, really, the purpose of Exit Planning Institute is to create more significant companies. And a significant company is one that is valuable, is transferable, and is aligned with the owner's personal and financial goals. And so Chris and I chose to fulfill that passion or fulfill that purpose through educating the professional advisor, which then would go work with the business owner.
Yeah. And you guys do a good job having networking groups in chapters across the entire country. In LA here, I think there's several. There's four or five now. Yep. And so I watched that really develop and attended many of those meetings. And so kudos to you. So your dad and you are in this business together, and you're the president. What's your dad's role in the business?
Yeah, so dad's our CEO, and he's our managing partner of our parent company called Snyder Premier Growth. So Dad and I have gone on to buy or invest in maybe five or six different companies since we bought EPI. I spent all my time here at EPI. Mm-hmm. But, you know, dad, it's kind of funny. We're moving into like that next stage, right? So if you kind of think about the history of the exit planning profession or EPI, we were founded in 2005. So I'm a second generation family business owner with my dad. But if you take in consideration the founders of the Exit Planning Institute, Pete Christman and Rich Jackham, I'm like third generation exit planning, right? So, and I think that we're starting to see the next generation of business owners more impacted by value growth and exit planning. So obviously that's one of my passions, being an exited owner and a part of that next generation of owners. But dad is our CEO and our managing partner. He takes on the CFO role as well. I don't like taxes and I don't like managing financials all that much, but he can give a good strategic look there. Mm-hmm. And I would say that probably his biggest role is maybe twofold. I would say that he's kind of like a chief content officer. So he's constantly writing content, trying to think of the next thing that SEPAs might want to talk about or share with business owners. And he's our head of faculty. So he's very active in our certified exit planning advisor credentialing program.
Yeah.
And he's coaching. So instead he's flipped his model a little bit, right? Instead of coaching and consulting the business owner, he's coaching and consulting the professional advisor who is trying to make a bigger impact with business owners.
Interesting.
So I run our day-to-day operations. I'm in charge of our three-year growth strategy, our P&L, and really, you know, managing our team here at EPI.
And who creates the vision and drives the vision for the business? Is that you and your dad together? Is that more your dad?
Yeah. No. It's me and dad together. I would say, again, really interesting, ever since like a year ago when we hit our global pandemic, you know, I think that like many, my dad's a baby boomer, like many baby boomer business owners, I'd like to think we're a little ahead of the game because we follow our own methodology. But dad's going through the same stuff as a guy in his 60s that many guys and gals in their 60s are going through in transition. So dad has focused a lot over the last year in personal planning, mm-hmm. in personal financial planning. So, and has really, we have a really good leadership team here. We got about 20 people here at the Exit Planning Institute now. We got about 2,600 certified exit planning advisors in the market. And the vision nowadays, we just actually recreated our three-year vision that takes us to the end of 2023. And it was really driven by our leadership team, influence from our SEPAs and me. And so for the first time, you're starting to see this next generation of exit planning kind of take place. But that for sure, he created the methodology that we all now kind of follow.
Right.
So he certainly still has quite a passion and a vision.
Well, and it's great when your customers or clients, as you might call them, which is your SEPA advisors, basically drive innovation by telling you what they want more of, less of. They're, you know, being in touch with your customers and hearing what they want helps you to shape the future of the business. And a lot of times we'll push us to innovate in ways that we hadn't thought about. So,
yeah, it's really like an ebb and flow, right? It's like we start to deliver new stuff. We see how you guys start to interact with it and use it. Yep. And then you kind of push back a little bit and say, hey, Scott, if you tweaked it like this, or if you dumped this and brought something like this, we could really connect better with owners. But you are spot on when it comes to understanding customers. Again, it goes back to just, you know, growing a smaller, rapidly growing company. I think that, you know, I think what we're seeing, if we really truly want to create significant companies, we need a robust set of certified exit planning advisors in the marketplace. And I think that, you know, in the past 3 years, EPI has been very concentrated on driving new certified exit planning advisors into the marketplace. But one of the things, one of my biggest lessons learned from COVID is really keeping your ear and eye to your customer. So the current certified exit planning advisor, I think at times, and, you know, for those, for you or for anybody that's really grown up, you know, growing a small, rapidly growing company, you kind of, again, another ebb and flow. It's like you're concentrating on this new business. Sometimes you forget about it. You have all this reoccurring business, you know, people like you that need support from EPI. And one of the things we spent really the last 8 months, maybe 6 months of 2020 doing was truly understanding our customer needs. And we revamped our whole member model for those of you, for those folks that retain their SEPA designation. We probably have the most robust member model that we've seen. And I'd like to think it's working. We went from about a 60% member renewal rate that was down in 2020 from about 85% traditionally. Mm-hmm. And now we're up at 93% renewals for the year.
That's fantastic. So,
you know, listening to your customers' needs and then pivoting and creating stuff that allows them to be a better advisor to their owner has been a critical move for us, for sure.
Super important. What's the economic engine that drives the EPI? Is it the professional certifications and there's a fee associated with getting that? Is that the primary
The biggest driver that we have is the credentialing program. So the Certified Exit Planning Advisor program.
Okay.
We'll certify 1,800 new SEPAs this year. So we'll almost double our membership in a year.
Wow.
The next probably tier is your retained membership, which is really not like a membership like you would have in an association. It's really like a license fee. So you're getting coaching, content, tools, assessments, research. We're doing marketing to the business owners, promoting the use of people that are credentialed with the SEPA designation.
Mm-hmm.
And then newly we're coming out with EPI, I guess what we're calling internally, at least for now, EPI Academy, which is, what we're seeing is, given that people that are becoming SEPA, regardless of what type of current advisor you are, consultant, financial advisor, CPA, attorney, investment banker, whatever it is, this is kind of a new profession for you, a new methodology that you learn. So what we're doing is coming out with an academy that allows you to further yourself and bring owners along with you. So that if, you know, I don't know if the SEPA designation is right for the business owner, but I would think that the basics of value acceleration might be.
Yeah.
So now an owner can come alongside you and you guys can learn and grow together. And now the idea here, right, is that we're almost matchmaking. We're saying we have a group of owners that believe in and understand value acceleration, and they're supported by trained certified advisors that are helping those owners that also speak the same language. So now everybody under the EPI tent or umbrella all speak value acceleration, kind of like, honestly, the books that you have behind you in your office, right? You have Scaling Up and EOS, two books that Traction is actually sitting right over there on my desk as well. So, you know, the implementer is kind of the same, you know, relationship that an implementer might have with an integrator and visionary.
Yes.
Where that coach or consultant, that implementer, speaking the same language as the people running that company. The step that I'm trying to take with EPI is I'm trying to take that and tie it to value. And I'm trying to tie in the personal and personal financial for the business owner. And so,
let me ask. So right. John Warlow built to Sell, author of The Automatic Customer, created the Sellability Index, which then became the Value Builder System. I became a Value Builder Advisor. What I thought was really interesting was he had this piece of software that you could kind of run the numbers and, well, if I improve this driver, how much will it move the needle on, you know, my EBITDA and, you know, my sale price, and which is going to move the needle the most. And obviously for most of the clients that I was looking at, the thing that moved the needle the most was like growing to a certain size, right? I mean, a $1 million company versus a $10 million versus a, you know, $100 million. Like the multiple changes dramatically because of the size. But it sounds like you're trying to build in some of that same methodology as well as match the advisor with the owner that wants to scale up and increase the value and go through that path together, which requires the challenge, as I experienced as a valuable advisor, is finding those entrepreneurs that have that longer term perspective and are willing to be patient and learn. They're driven as entrepreneurs, and only the real true entrepreneurs that are serial entrepreneurs, value builders, seem to me the ones that were most interested in it. The ones who were a technician turned entrepreneur, you know, the landscaper who was like, God, I got to learn this business stuff. I mean, you know, they're kicking and screaming. They only go into traction when an EOS methodology, when the pain is so great that they're like, we've got to fix this. You know,
yeah, I mean, we would call that, like, we would call what you're talking about right now at EPI, we would call that decentralizing the owner, right? So I think that, you know, being a landscaper myself, to me, like, landscaping is like a young man's game, right? Like, I can remember I had a very short-lived internship. So at high school, we had this, like, we had five terms instead of four quarters. And the fifth term for seniors, you would have to go do, like, I don't know, like a four-week or five-week internship. So obviously being landscaper, I went to a landscape company for another guy that owned a landscape company that went to the high school that I went to. And I can remember my foreman, Ken, he was 65 years old at the time. So I was probably like 17. And Ken had been working at like Connolly Landscaping since he was 15. So can you, and they did more like design build. So he was like on his hands and knees laying brick paver patios, right? Yeah, and like, I couldn't imagine spending 40 years of my life doing that. He had two wrist braces on, two knee braces, one elbow brace, back brace. So I'm saying, could you imagine now if that was the owner of the business and that owner operator type feel, that like almost maybe more lifestyle company, you know? I think that in those types of trade type businesses, even more so decentralizing the owner so that business can continue, I think is absolutely critical. And it's really not just about building a better business. It's about really building a better life.
Yeah. The single greatest tool as a coach in my tool chest has always been what I call the strategic focus, which is, I call it the vital few and trivial many. It's practicing that Pareto principle. It's, you know, it's really finding out what are the 20% things that you're best at, and like laying bricks or doing, you know, irrigation or doing the actual work of landscaping is not the most valuable work. If you want to make $200,000 in personal income and above, you've got to get out of that level type work. And so I've done a lot of coaching over the years with many clients, trying to help them elevate their strategic mindset and get them into thinking about what is going to be more valuable. And so what I've found is that there's a next generation leader in these family businesses that they're more business educated than I was. I grew up almost a product of the 60s, where we were trying to change society and marching against wars and things like that. We weren't as much interested in business, but this next generation of leaders, they're tech savvier, they're business smarter, they're educated, and they see the potential, and the platform becomes, my mom or dad have built this trades business that really, it could be so much better with more people, better software, better systems, better processes, more profits. And I have a different vision. And so, you know, they drive it with some BHAG, big hairy audacious goal. They want to 10x the company. So
I think that, like, in the exit planning world, I do a lot of like generational studies, right? So we're trying to I think the biggest hurdle for any advisor that now wants to talk exit planning with any type of owner is that owner probably is a little misinformed about what exit planning really is, right? I think most people, if you plop that question, they would say, well, exit planning sounds like something that I like the sale of my company would do. It would be something that I do 12, 18, 24 months before I'm kind of get ready to sell. What they don't realize is that we do things as business owners every single day in our business that eventually affect our exit or have an effect on our personal or personal financial life. So, you know, if I told you I could give you happier customers with more efficiencies, with a better culture, talented people, decentralize you and give you some more time back in your life, I think most owners would be like, and we could make a lot of money doing it. I think most owners would be like, yeah, it sounds great. Well, that is exit planning.
Right.
But when you look at the generations and you talk about that next generation inside those companies, particularly the Gen Xers, so people say in their 40s or early 50s, I think they're primed up for exit planning. This is a generation that their core, one of their core values is they value their time. They believe in a work-life balance. They believe in working smarter and not harder. And I think their spending habit is save, save, save. So in that generation, if you think about exit planning in those terms, like I think we'll see a lot of Gen Xers, 40 people in their 40s, people in their early 50s, really embrace the value acceleration methodology and embrace exit planning. And if you look at the millennials, so perhaps guys like me, you know, I'm like a financial planner's worst nightmare. So my spending habit is earn to spend, right? Like I'm supposed to like put some into this account that my financial planner is supposed to go. Right. He checks the account. He shoots me an email or a text like, Scott, man, like you were supposed to make a deposit. And I was like, oh yeah. You know, I decided to book a trip to the Caribbean. And he's like, dude, you know, and he's, you know, and so, but if you look all the way to our most immediate marketplace, look at the baby boomers, they are, their ability to handle crisis is unbelievable. So they probably navigated this pandemic better than most.
Yes.
But, you know, they don't have really a business problem per se. They probably have more of a personal or financial problem because these guys and gals are the inventors of the 60-hour work week. So they're a very active and passionate generation. Their core value is success. So whether it's their business, their family, their marriage, their golf game, whatever it is, they want to feel successful in what they do. So I think it's just really interesting as you started to talk about the next generation of owners or managers. And when I think about exit planning, we do a ton of research. I have some on my desk now. I do a ton of research around understanding the generation so that we could tailor the exit planning message to them.
Well, I think that's very insightful and interesting for you to share that with me because so you're going after the Gen Xers. You think that they're the right age for being able to learn and make the implementations suggestions that are going to drive value in their business. And I go after the millennials because I think the ones who really have the ambition and the drive and the hunger to scale up and are willing to learn, recognizing that what got them here is not going to get them there, that what mom or dad knows and could teach them is like they already learned that. And now they need to find a new mentor who's skilled and can bring a playbook and a scaling up methodology and help them implement like EOS or scaling up or whatever it is. Just thinking if it's just the E-Myth concepts, but get them to that next level. So it makes sense that the 40 to 55 year olds are really thinking more about how do I exit and what do I need to do? I find though, the people that come to me and want to do exit and succession, they're already in their 60s and they're still working so hard and they put me off and say, well, I know it's going to require 2 or 3 years, but like, they don't seem to ever get to that 2 to 3 years, like planning timeframe where it starts seems to be a moving target, like a moving goalpost, right? We know that if you played football with a moving goalpost, you'd lose a lot of fans. And
it's always like a hard deal for them to kind of get right with, right? Is that if you talk to even my dad, like my dad's one of his biggest passions is being a business owner. Like he loves his business. To us, we don't show up to the office and go to work. We show up to the office and it's like hanging out. It's like going to the golf course or whatever your hobby is. Like I love being here. We just actually came back to in-person work environment, if you want to be. And seeing about probably 75% of our team come back into the office to kind of combine together and obviously while being socially distant, but you know, I'm just looking at the guys outside of my office. There's like a, you know, I love coming in here.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really hard for somebody like my dad to look at, okay, what does the next 10, 20, 30 years of my life look like without this business really in my life anymore? And that's why I think the personal financial planning for particularly a baby boomer owner is so critical. And I also think that the reality of it is that, you know, you're older, right? So you're like driving around a used car. So, you know, your health is, it's not a concern, but it's something that you need to be more aware of. It's like, I was to one of the last in-person speaking engagements I had before the pandemic hit. I was speaking to a group of mixed group of advisors and owners. And there was three ladies, probably all in their mid 50s to upper 60s. And the one lady came up to me afterwards and she said, it was a mixed audience of owner and advisor. And these were owners. They came up to me and said, Scott, we'd love to, like, you know, are you from the area? And you know, I was actually over in Pittsburgh and had driven in from Cleveland. And I was like, no, I'm over in Cleveland. And like, we'd love to, like, you know, if you're not doing anything after, you know, buying a cup of coffee or lunch so we could talk more, because your story really hit us. I was talking about what we teach about at the EPI called the 5 D's, these kind of involuntary things that force us out of our business, a death, a divorce, disability, a partner dispute or disagreement. And it was kind of a sad story. It was so it would have been January of 2020. And she said in November of 2019, her and her three sisters for the past 20 years had owned a gourmet grocery store that her father started when he came over from like Italy or something like that. And they bought it from their dad. And, you know, they weren't gifted the business. They actually bought it and they came in, and one of their older sisters had the majority ownership and was their like CEO and was kind of in EOS terms, right? They're truly their visionary.
Mm-hmm.
And she got cancer in November of 2019. And by Christmas of 2019, she had passed away. And the next month, the other two sisters had like an awful disagreement, so much of a disagreement that they had to shut down the business, and her sister don't even talk anymore. And I'm saying, like, what a shame. They spent 20 years together, probably getting along to some extent for those of us in a family business, kind of along, that's not always all hunky dory. But nonetheless, I just think that, and I think it's a perfect example for one. If you're in your 50s, 60s, or 70s, you got to get right with maybe understanding your age a little bit and understanding what your body needs. And I think that that could happen to any of us. So I think as business owners, we kind of have like an obligation almost to take care of our people, take care of our customers, our vendors, because here, if me and Chris died, if the people here didn't know what to do, if that happened, and our business couldn't survive, 20 people would be out of jobs and 2,600 SEPAs would be out of a designation.
Yeah.
Right. I just think that it's not, you know, I think as owners, we have a little bit bigger of an obligation than just owning a business. So anyways, yeah, when you're talking about, you know, different generations and how they're looking at exit. Yeah. I think it's difficult for baby boomers to think about the next act of their life.
Yeah.
I think it's so critical.
And what happened to we called it the silver tsunami that was supposed to happen, right? Where everyone was going to exit their businesses because they were baby boomers. And it didn't seem to really happen.
No, I think it goes back to generation. Our company was founded on the $10 trillion opportunity, right? So Pete and Rich did a bunch of research in 2005. And they said, look, in the next 10 years, all these baby boomers, these 4.5 million businesses, this $10 trillion of wealth in the next 10 years is going to transition. Well, 10 years, that would have been 2015.
Right.
So here we are about 6 years later and we're still not seeing it.
Right.
But I think that what they lacked, what Pete and Rich didn't really compare it to, was the generational traits. So you think back, call it 10 years ago, my dad would have been only 52 years old. He wasn't really ready for exit, anywhere near ready for exit.
Right. Exactly.
But now at 62 years old, now my dad's a new grandpa. My mom retired. He's got a lake house. He's starting to step, the business doesn't need him to operate anymore. He's starting to think about different things, right? He goes to the doctor for a checkup, right? So there's some different things going on in his life now that he's in his early 60s. And I think if you looked at the top of the baby boomers, they're maybe in their upper 60s, early 70s. And I think if you look at the bottom, in the next 5 or 10 years, I think all boomers are going to be 60 or older. So I think it's natural now. I think that the silver tsunami is like right now, because yeah, I think it's natural. Again, inventors of the 60-hour work week. Inventors of a 60-hour work week. My dad wasn't anywhere near retiring.
But here's the thing. A previous guest just a few episodes ago, who's from your area of the country, and a friend and colleague of mine, Jim Uhlhausen, he wrote a book called Half Retire. And I think that is going to be what happens, because I don't see a person like your dad who I see from what I've seen of him. He enjoys being in the game as long as his mind is vital, as long as he can, you know, participate, do some coaching, do some mentoring, you know, and be.
You part sound of like my dad. That's exactly. If my dad was sitting right next to me, he would have just said that same thing.
I'm going to be, I'm in that place too. I'm probably about the same age. So I'm 63 years old and my business is kind of a lifestyle business. And sometimes I feel like I'm half retired and I'm half really engaged in it. And it's nice. Yeah. It's nice to have that balance, because I know I can do this for a long time and I probably will be. So.
Well, I think it goes to, you know, the way in which owners are taught how to exit, right? I think a lot of owners think about one bite of the apple. Yeah. I think about it in multiple bites of the apple.
Yes, exactly.
And so I think there's multiple bites. I think there's a perfect strategy for a baby boomer business owner. Yeah, let's stay involved, but let's de-risk our personal financial portfolio. Your business is just another asset inside of your financial portfolio. So let's de-risk that personal financial portfolio a little bit, take some chips off the table, and take multiple bites of the apple along the way, even if it's to one exit option, even if it's a family business and I'm going to buy 10% from dad here, 20% from dad here, and we're on like a 5 or 6 year plan. And then for dad, you know, we're lucky to be in like a very high growth business.
Yeah.
I don't think it really makes a lot of sense for my dad to exit now.
No.
Because we're set to grow 5 times over the next 3 years. So,
why would you want to
answer that? You know, dad's kind of saying, you know, I don't want to work every day, but I certainly, from an investment standpoint, I'd rather have, you know, the upside. But he might not want, you know, 50% of the upside. He might sell 10%, take him down to 40, and take 40% of something 5 times bigger versus 50% of something now.
Are you guys 50-50 partners in your business? Can you share?
We're like 51-49. You know, Dan didn't want to take.
And so, can you talk either specifically about your business or generally to listeners about what does that? How does that transition work? So, some of my clients use the lifetime gifting exemption that they have, gift tax exemption, and they transfer that way. Others are holding on to all the equity and kind of control it till the bitter end or whatever. Others are having their kids buy in. I mean, what would be some of your recommendations in that area?
So I would say number one recommendation, I think that you got to have skin in the game. Mm-hmm. So I think that buying in, I don't really believe in the whole gifting your business to your kids. I think it doesn't do any good for either side. One, I don't necessarily personally want to be gifted something. I want to sit next to my dad as an equal.
Yeah.
I put in my money. I'm risking it too. On the flip side, I think that for the generation that's gifting it, for so to say dad is gifting it to me, I think they're just saying like, here's a gift. Like, here's all my problems. Here are my issues. So if you're not thinking about it as a gift and you're thinking about it as something of value that you could sell, you might think about it in a little bit different of a way. So at least for our family, we're not, and I would recommend any family business owner, I would buy it. Although for the older generation that's trying to exit, it's probably not the most lucrative option. And it's probably not the quickest option out. Like, right. Like, so if I'm going to buy dad's 50%, I can't afford to buy the whole thing right now. I mean, I could, if he wants to hold a seller's note, I can go get some money from the bank. I could qualify for that. And then dad's going to have to have a seller's note. So it might take a longer way or have a longer runway. But so, I mean, what we're doing now is that what dads, I think, you know, what we're trying to figure out is we're trying to tie ourselves into the next 3 to really 5 years you know, what is a 3 to 5 year strategy for our business, and when does it make sense for dad to exit? But he's in what we were just talking about. Dad is saying like, look, I don't know if I want to exit completely, because if you can hit what you're what the vision is, if you can hit what the growth plan says,
yeah,
we're going to be 5 times bigger just in 3 years. He's like, I want to part. I don't know. He's like, I don't want to work 60, 70 hours a week with you anymore.
Right.
But I definitely want a big, I want to be a part of that, that 5 times bigger in three years. So, you know, it really, I would go back and kind of round out that little rant that I had is like, dad is defining what we would call at EPI, his wealth gap. When dad's wealth gap is gap no more, dad's good. You know, dad's pretty honest. He's like, look, I got everything that I want. He's like, I'm a grandfather. I got 2 great kids. I got a lake house. I got a place down in Florida. I got my home here in Cleveland. And my dad and mom really, when they had me 35 years ago, they were sitting in an apartment, literally counting nickels on a kitchen table. So both of my parents have come and worked for everything that they had. And I don't, my parents are pretty humble people. So they're like, I can't possibly think what more I can have. So my dad needs to close his wealth gap a little bit, but if he can do that over the next 2 or 3 years, dad might sell. And then the reality of it is, I think for business owners, given our current climate in the United States, if capital gains taxes go up, he might want to sell now, you know? So
I think it's definitely case specific in each family also, because I think that the younger generation can drive a lot more value in the business. And if they're doing the hard work and driving the value, then, you know, dad can gift some of the stock of the business and recognize that the value is being created by that next generation. So, all right. Absolutely. Well, interesting discussion. We're going to wrap up. Let me ask you two closing questions. One is, do you have a BHAG for your business?
Yeah, I do. I would say, I don't know if it's, you know, like burn harness, particularly framed and defined, but I would say that the BHAG is, I'd love to see value acceleration taught inside of colleges and universities. So when somebody's going through a business program and they're in their intro to business management courses, the way in which they're learning how to grow a business is by the use of our methodology.
Got it. So like a Microsoft, a computer on every desk type of a, you know,
kind of like that,
of a vision.
Kind of like that.
Do you follow a playbook in your business, like the EOS traction playbook or scaling up method or the value acceleration methodology, just to manage the people, the processes, and the priorities in your business?
Yeah, 100%. So here's our vision track and traction organizer right here.
Gotcha.
So here's EOS. So from a standpoint of like tracking that kind of stuff, I used to be a Vern Harnish guy. My folks here at EPI, my team find it easier to follow EOS. So we started doing that. But really, that's just a, you know, communication and management tool. I would say, and it probably sounds, of course, like this guy would say that, but I don't know any other way to grow and exit a business than value acceleration. You could say like my book, my dad's book was Walking to Destiny. My book is going to be growing up through the value acceleration methodology.
Mm-hmm.
So in short, my answer is I follow value acceleration methodology, because what it does is also bring in the personal and personal financial. So as a 35-year-old business owner, I have really been able to align my business goals with my personal goals and my personal financial goals. And so the value acceleration methodology is the process that we follow here.
Great. And so if the listener wants to get a hold of that methodology, where do they find it?
If you just navigate two ways, one, you could go to earncepa.com. So CEPA. So if you just go to earncepa.com, you can see everything value acceleration.
Right.
On the flip side, I think nowadays, easy enough, go to LinkedIn, type in Scott Snyder, S-N-I-D-E-R, and we share content. You can see my contact information, all that kind of good stuff.
Fantastic. And we'll share that in the show notes. And what was just supposed to be an interesting conversation, I think, just turned into our podcast. So
cool, man.
Scott,
sounds good.
Thanks so much. I'll do an intro before this. And So this was another episode of the Disruptive Successor podcast show with Scott Snyder, a disruptive successor himself and an entrepreneur. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, the Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at the goldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Thank you for joining us on the Disruptive Successor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, review, and share with a friend who would benefit from the message. If you're interested in picking up a copy of my book, Disruptive Successor, go to disruptivesuccessor.com.